right, so 15 years old, Kentwood, Michigan, all right? Saturday afternoon. I get the call. My boys want to hang out at Woodland Mall. Cool. I head out, grab that members only jacket in case any girlies happen by. The plan, simple. Avoid mall security at all costs. Bookstore, cologne emporium, not doing anybody any harm. Then we come to the record shop, and I see this lady. Actually, everyone sees her. She's brownish, with a large floral print covering. She's older, maybe even ancient. And her makeup is thick. Thick over her face, even under her chin. Streaks of powder and paint. Eyes shadowed in violet, but more than the mascara and the rouge, more than the burning red streak of lipstick parting her face, she's wearing this sense of menace. Even as she smiles at me. Hello, Glenn Washington. Like she knows me. Like she's known me for a long time. But I'm certain, absolutely certain, I have never seen this woman before in my life. Before I can ask, she says, how do I know your name, Glenn Washington? I know a lot of things, Glenn Washington. I know about William Thomas Washington and Phoebe Washington. I know about her as well. So, my mom and dad? Your cousin Virgil Washington.
Uh-huh.
And then she says a name. A name that my parents don't know, that my brother doesn't know. She says a name that nobody knows. And I feel my friends backing away from this woman even as I am frozen in place. In fact, Glenn Washington, I know more about you than you do. And I've got a secret you need to know right now. I look at her oily, puffy, made-up face, her blazing eyes, and I run. Push through shoppers, knock down a stand of sunglasses, vials of body oil flying onto the floor. I outpace my friends who are running right behind me, and I can't stop until I get outside, bent over in the parking lot, gasping this cold air. Who the hell was that? Ask Grant, like I'm supposed to know. Dude, I have no idea. That is true, as far as it goes. But I do have secrets. My family has secrets. We've put dark things underground, buried. Things no reverend, no priest, no angels, and no rainbows can ever make better. And I can't help but wonder if those dark things have returned. Today, on Snap Judgment, from WNYC, Spooked 6, The Awakening. Amazing. All news stories from real people fighting the forces of the night. My name is Glenn Washington. I must insist that you turn on each and every light because you're listening to Snap Judgment. We're going to kick off today's Snap Judgment Spooked episode with one of the most celebrated and investigated psychic phenomena cases in modern history. Frances was a software engineer in Silicon Valley when she and her husband went to Louisiana to look at old plantation houses. Thought about maybe opening an inn when they retired. Snap Judgment. Thank you.
I first went into St. Francisville, people started calling me Sarah, and I had no idea why. And they'd apologize and say, I have no idea why I'm calling you Sarah. And we really weren't looking to buy anything at that time. We thought maybe one day when we retire, we'll buy an inn, but we were more just checking out the town. And when the real estate agent said, well, there is this one place, it's called the Myrtles. It's like electricity went through my body. I felt, I don't know, I felt like it was supposed to be. The first time I walked in the house, it felt familiar. We loved the place. My husband and I, Jim, we wanted to turn it into a guest inn. You know, we were young, crazy, in love, and we just decided to do it. We were a good team, and we loved being together. To move to St. Francisville, we gave up everything we owned. We sold all our property. We quit our jobs. And I think the hardest part was leaving my family and friends and moving halfway across the country. It was tough, but we were excited. I didn't specifically ask, are there any ghosts here? I would have no reason to ask that. I mean, I had no clue coming from California that the house had any kind of reputation. Apparently, for at least 100 years, it's had a reputation for having a ghost. As I learned later, the owner told the employees, you know, make sure you keep that secret. They didn't want anybody to know, especially a prospective buyer. I had a pretty fast introduction to the ghost, probably within the first couple of weeks. I was pretty convinced. I would hear footsteps back and forth in the hallways at night. It was fairly soon after I moved in, I would say within a month, so it must have been springtime when I first heard the children. The first time this happened, I was alone in my bedroom in the middle of the night, and it sounded as if it was in the room with me. Mommy, Mommy. I knew that the children were looking for somebody to save them, and it was quite frequent, but I didn't know how to help them, and I felt totally helpless. It was one of my first days there, and so I was there alone, and I sat down in the sitting room, and I must have decided I wanted something because I got up to go back out, and the door was locked, and I thought, oh, well, that's weird. There's really no key and no lock, but so I went to the other door, another door, and it was locked. And by then I'm thinking, okay, this is creeping me out. And I went to the third door, and that was locked too. And there's no way these doors can be locked. Pulled on the doorknob, I pulled the door, and the doors would not come open. And these were internal doors, so there was no deadbolt. There was no locks on the door. And I grabbed the handle and pulled with all my might. And the doors just wouldn't come open. So I run to the windows and try to get the windows open, and those are all painted shut. So by then, I'm practically screaming. I don't know what's going on. My mind is racing. I run to the phone. I pick up the receiver. I hold my breath. Thank God there was a dial tone. I dialed Betty Jo. I don't know how well I explained it, but she did come right over. And I sat there on the floor waiting for her, just praying. I didn't know what to do. And finally, I hear a car drive up. I look out the window, and it's Betty Jo. She comes running up to the door, and she's pounding on the door, trying to get in. She can't get the door open. And like I said, the door's never locked. There's no way they could lock. And she said, hold on, I'll be right back. And she went to get a tire iron. And I can see her run out to the car and run back up to the house with the tire iron. And the next thing I know, she's in the room helping me up. and she told me that when she got to the door, it just fell open. I couldn't stand up. My legs gave out. I was completely torn because on the one hand, I loved the house. I had so many plans and left all my friends. So I was embarrassed too, because what was I supposed to say? Oh my goodness, I came home because there's a ghost. But yeah, I did have second thoughts. But I just, being there felt so right. I never thought that I was hallucinating. I thought that what I saw was really manifesting, but I had no idea what it was. So I did doubt my sanity, maybe, or maybe the whole universe. I don't know. We just sort of had an unwritten rule that after dark, you don't talk about the ghost. The experiences became progressively more and more frequent, especially at night, but also during the day. I would hear children calling out, and they'd say, "Mommy, Mommy." And sometimes other people heard it too. Sometimes they didn't, but it always ripped my heart out. I absolutely felt a drive to try to help them. What does a regular person do when you're hearing these things? I didn't know. You know, I wanted to do something, and I wanted to learn more about the history. And we did do a lot of research and talk to a lot of the local people and people who knew the house. And that's when people were calling me Sarah. I must have asked who Sarah was. In the history of the home, there was a couple of owners. One of the most famous was Sarah Matilda and her two little girls, and her husband, Judge Clark Woodruff. And as the legend goes, the judge would force one of the female slaves to go upstairs with him to the nursery when the children were out playing, where he would have his way with them. And the slave, being very young, was always trying to protect herself. And, well, she was afraid she was going to lose her status as a house servant. And she decided that to save herself, she would make the family very ill, and then she could save them and be the hero. And so she baked a poisonous oleander flower into the children's birthday cake. It backfired because that night Sarah Matilda and the two little girls died in the house. I think as time went on and the two little girls kept appearing and we would hear more and more of them, I figured out that it had to be them. I do feel that's why I was drawn to the house, and I felt that since the day I first went to look and looked up the back staircase. I felt like I had lived there before, if that's possible. The two little girls had been seen quite often. Like, we'd have a school group come through, and the teacher would send me a photograph and say, "This is our class, but who are the two little girls standing next to them?" And a lot of people thought that they were my two little girls because I have blonde hair and they had blonde hair and they were dressed in old-time clothing. And they thought that was so cute, I would dress my children in old-time clothing. I just, in a way, I did almost feel as if, you know, they were related or they were my children or they were in my keep. I was alone at the house. We had a very unusual snow and ice storm in Louisiana. I mean, that never happened. So the pipes froze. There was no water. Most of the staff, and I think even Jim, went to either a hotel or went home somewhere. So I was surprised that we still had electricity, but we did. And I was watching TV, feeling very comfortable. And the electricity goes out. And, of course, we found a book from the 1800s that said, whenever all the lights go out at the Myrtles, something always happens. So All of a sudden, I'm just thrown into complete terror, and I walk out into the entry hall. I look up, and I saw a lady dressed in black. She had black hair, and she pleaded with me to help her. She looked right down at me. She said, "Help me." And I didn't know what to do. I think at that moment, my first instinct was to get out of the house. And I did. I ran. It's easy to say what you do, you know, when you're talking about it. But when you're faced with a ghost, even though it's not a big ogre or, you know, even though it was a lady, I just wanted to get out of there. And it was only afterwards when I thought about it, I felt so awful that I didn't have the nerve to stay. You know, it really did come together with so many people calling me Sarah, and here's Sarah and everything being so familiar that, you know, it just all came together that I was her. I could almost feel her pain, and when her husband cheated on her, or when the children would cry, I could feel for her. I felt it so strongly that I felt it must be even something more than a woman-to-woman empathy. I've never felt anything that like that before. It was so powerful. It's a day I'll never forget. I was out visiting friends, and I came home, and I started looking around for Jim. And I finally go up to the bedroom door, and I open it, not thinking anything of it. And I saw my husband in bed with one of the helpers, and they were having sex. I couldn't talk. I backed out of the room and ran. I called a friend. I had her pick me up. I just wanted to get out. I also had some sort of memory that in 1824, what happened to Sarah, she walked up to the bedroom door and caught her husband in bed with a slave. What happened to the slave was absolutely horrific. The poor slave lady was the victim. I didn't sleep at all that night. I was terrified. I was shaking. It was probably the worst night of my life. And I was scared that I was going to die that night because I knew that Sarah had died that night. It was a really hard decision to leave, and I grieved over leaving, but I knew that I had to, or I could literally lose my life. It was June 13th, and I packed up all my bags, and the staff and some of my friends were there, and I hugged everybody goodbye. Everybody was crying. I couldn't stop crying. And I got in my car and drove away. And I didn't look back.
Thank you, Frances Kermeen, for sharing your story with Snap. Now, for those of you brave enough, the Myrtles is listed as one of the most haunted places in America, and you can spend the night. Find out how we'll have the 411 at snapjudgment.org. But if you can't get down to Louisiana, not to worry, Snappers, because Frances has a book, The Myrtles Plantation. You can find a link to that at snapjudgment.org as well. The original score for that piece was by Renzo Gorio. It was produced by Anna Sussman.
throughout the world, vampires have existed in both legend and fact. Those that rose from the grave in a restless and eternal prowling that could only be satiated by the sucking of a living victim's blood.
When Snap Judgment continues, something arises from an accident scene that shouldn't arise at all. And a promise to maintain contact even after the grave. When Snap Judgment, the Spooked Six Awakening episode continues, stay tuned. Special episode of Snap Judgment, Spooked Six, The Awakening. Today, we're asking real people to tell us their stories of bumping up against the inexplicable. And our next piece comes from the most real person you're likely to ever meet. See, when Oscar Mendoza was born, his grandmother told his mother that this baby had a gift. Now, Oscar will never say that she was wrong, but he prefers to call it a curse. Sensitive listeners, please note, this story does contain graphic imagery and violence.
It all started with the annual family vacation to San Felipe. I always hated going to Mexico. We were used to creature comforts, you know, like TV and air conditioning. And over there, some people don't even have electricity. You know, the only times we would really enjoy it is whenever there was a carnival in town. My father would drive literally from Dallas all the way to Mexico without stopping. It was like a 19-hour drive. When we first got there, it was maybe around 3 in the morning. That night, we stopped at a taco stand, and there was a dog that somehow just stuck to us. He just literally followed us home, and the next day he was there, and he just literally stayed with us all the time. And we lived on the main street. It was carnival, so there was rides everywhere, there were parades, and there were food vendors. Imagine the state fair, but in your house, you know, or in your neighborhood. That's how cool it was. The first thing I've seen was the girls in kind of like bikini things, you know, saying hi to everybody, and they're winking at people, they winked at us, and we got, you know, shy. You know, it's something you really don't see every day. Once we heard the music and we heard clowns were coming, we jumped on top of my dad's car. The clowns were, you know, making people laugh. We were having a good time. They're giving us candy. You know, we love candy. And then that's when we heard the explosion. We just saw this clown fly through the air, and it landed maybe like a couple of feet away from us. We heard his body thump. We didn't know what was going on. We thought it was part of the act. My brother, you know, he was just being jokester. Like, was laughing. He was laughing and pointing. His face was toward the cement. And then my brother noticed that he turned around, the clown turned around and looked at us. You know what, I swear to God, he smiled at us. Had his look in his eyes were open. And my brother almost peed in his pants. You know, he told me, he turned around and looked at me. And then once that happened, you know, my mother heard it and she came out and grabbed us and goes, "Get inside the house." Of course, we didn't listen. We ran up the stairs and we were on the balcony. Then we were looking at them, at the chaos from the top, and that's when we seen the whole view of the carnage. And what happened is that this truck had lost control coming into the town, instantly killing a bunch of people and hitting the clown car, making the clowns fly up in the air. Police police came, they couldn't really do anything until somebody came in with a truck and put all the bodies on the trucks and took them away. And once everything cleared up, you know, they washed the streets off with water. Yeah, I felt in my bones we shouldn't have made fun of the clown. We ate dinner. We went to bed. My parents never brought it up. They figured, you know, don't talk about it, it never happened. We all started to sleep together because my brother was really scared. My brother wasn't one of those people that was really scared of anything. And to this day, he's the toughest guy I know. But, you know, that night he wasn't as tough. My older cousin, she was 15. And so she was our, kind of like our babysitter / bodyguard. So yeah, we all slept in one bed. That night, around 3 in the morning, my brother wakes up sweating. He asked my cousin, hey, can you go with me to the restroom? I need to get some water. I need to go to the restroom. My cousin, you know, she's older. She goes, sure, I'll go with you. She grabs his hand. In the room, there's two doors. One door leads to the hallway that's my grandpa's room. This door would lead to the kitchen. There had a huge hole in the middle, like a round hole the size of a ball that we use as a handle. And my cousin held the door open. And as soon as she opened the door, that's when we saw him. We saw him sitting there. He was sitting in a chair looking toward the wall. He was wearing a gray jumpsuit. And he was wearing what I think was a mask, a clown mask. He had a bald head with hair on the sides like a clown. Opaque white. Wasn't makeup. It wasn't a mask. That skin was too real. And I suddenly realized what clown that was. That was the actual clown that my brother was laughing at. And as soon as she opened the door, that's when he turned around. And my cousin shut the door real quick. And that's when we heard the impact of the door. It moved the door so bad, we thought it was going to break. And my cousin, you know, she's a pretty big girl. She was leaning against it. And my brother was leaning against it. And I jumped over and leaned against it too. And every time it pushed, we could see him. Because once he hit the door, the door would swing open and we would push it back. The thing was ramming itself against it. He stopped. And then he put his eye through the hole in the door. And we see his powdery face. He goes, let me in. Let me in. Don't be mean.
No sean malos.
I just want to play with you. He looked around and then he put his arm through the hole and tried to grab my cousin's hair. He had a white glove full of blood in his hand and his wrist was cut. And then we were crying and screaming, Grandpa, Grandpa. As soon as we said Grandpa, my grandpa jumps out of his bed on the other side. We heard him and he had the dog in his room. He lets the dog go. We hear the dog run. He ran, you know, ran to the streets of the kitchen. You know, he started growling and snarling and fighting him, you know, and that's what we heard. And then my grandfather came out with a gun, you know, he came out with a gun. He goes, who's there? You know, so I'm going to shoot you. But in Spanish, like, ¿quién está allí? Los voy a matar. He goes, salgan de aquí, si no los mato. And he ran up the stairs, whatever this thing was, ran up the stairs, and we heard it jump from the roof, and it landed on the cement. And I was thinking, this guy just killed himself. And my grandfather went outside. We're looking for blood or anything. Nothing. It disappeared. Whatever it was. You know, we would have seen something. We didn't see anything. As soon as my grandfather walked in, we went looking for our dog. And we found him next to the patio, which is the yard in the middle of our house, laying there lifeless. It's a traumatic situation when you hear an animal die, you know, trying to defend you. And my grandfather picked him up, put him in a towel and put him in a truck and took him away. You know, in the morning the police came in, he looked at all the scene, and the only thing that was left in the kitchen was this pile of black ooze. It smelled horrible. And the police officer told my grandfather, you know, you should really get a priest over here and bless this house. You know, I don't think this guy was a clown. I think era el diablo. It was a devil. And then, you know, my grandpa got really freaked out. After that, we never studied in that house again. It was too horrific, the experience. And to this day, you know, my brother and my cousins, we discuss the same story over and over because nobody believes us. You know, like nobody believes that we saw a zombie clown, you know, that attacked us in the middle of the night. You know, the only thing I fear, and I fear for everybody that hears this story, whatever we experience will follow somebody. You know, because my grandma used to always tell me, don't ever talk about this, because you don't want to release this thing to anybody else. And I truly believe that's true.
You're dying to hear more about the creepy life of Oscar Mendoza. Listen to the podcast Real Ghost Stories online, where you'll find stories from him and many others. We'll have details on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original score was done by Leon Morimoto. The piece was produced by Anna Adlerstein. You're listening to Spook 6, The Awakening, and understand, if you dig A Walk on the Dark Side, there is plenty more where this came from. Full hours, some of the scariest true life stories ever aired, Spook 1, Spook 2, 3, Spook 4, and Spook 5, available right now. More ghouls than you can shake a coffin at waiting for you right now at snapjudgment.org. And when Snap Judgment returns, know this, some promises can never ever be extinguished. When Spook 6, The Awakening continues, stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, Spook 6 from WNYC. My name is Glenn Washington, and this is the one time of the year that Snap tries to peer behind that gossamer curtain between the quick and the dead, the dark and the light, and the lie and the truth. For our next piece, we're going deep into the mountains of Kentucky to a town they call Bloody Harlan. Sensitive listeners should be aware that this story does contain material related to actual violence. Our story starts when young Darla Jackson was just a girl.
I was probably about 7 years old. Me and my grandmother and grandfather went blackberry picking up on Little Shepherd Trail. As we were picking berries, my grandfather pointed down the hillside and he said, "Do you remember hearing about the young girl that was found dead up here? She was found right over there." Everyone wanted to speak of it as a horror story because it was. You know, a young girl found stabbed, decomposing in the woods. No one ever identified her. It was always scary, but I really never heard about a ghost until James saw her.
The unidentified girl was buried in a pauper cemetery on a hillside above Harlan. Over time, the story of her murder became a local legend. And then, 31 years later, in November of the year 2000.
At Thanksgiving dinner, my Uncle James pulled me aside and he began to tell me about his experience at his current home, which was a little trailer, up on a mountain in an area called Red Dog Road. Most of the area was a cemetery, and he basically stumbled upon the grave of an unidentified girl. And when he did, he immediately remembered who this was. And it was a young girl that had been found on Pine Mountain in 1969. And he told me that he wanted me to solve her murder. He wanted me to go to the police and that he wanted to give me his journal.
Now, Darla's not an investigator. She's a funeral home director in Harlan, Kentucky. But her Uncle James was agitated. He said that in his journal, he had written down exactly what happened after he had stumbled across the girl's grave, an encounter he just couldn't explain. This is an excerpt from James Saylor's journal.
In early morning hours, something awakened me. It was not a sound, but more of a presence. I sat up and looked around my room. I immediately saw a young woman there. She was not a wisp, a mist, an outline, or a blur. She was as clear as you might see anyone. She stood looking out the window. I slowly stood up and began to approach her. When I did, she disappeared. I only saw her left profile. She never looked at me. She was gazing intently out the window at the city of Harlan. Her face was expressionless. She acted as if I was the one that did not exist.
As Darla read James's journal, it brought up more and more questions for her. Who exactly was this girl, and what did she look like?
And he said that she was rather small and that she was wearing 1960s clothing. She had jeans on with suede stitching going down the sides. She had on a white t-shirt, reddish strawberry blonde hair that was about shoulder length, and that she was pretty.
James needed to know. Had he seen the ghost of the unidentified girl? And so he went into town and sorted through the Harlan Library's newspaper archives. And eventually he found an article written the week the unidentified girl was buried. It had a physical description of her. Under 20 years old, white, 5'3", medium build, reddish blonde hair. James came home from the library, and even though it was dark out, he walked into the woods and returned to the site of the unidentified girl's grave.
I knew in my mind and in my heart that what was happening was not natural. I slowly stood and walked over to the grave. I spoke out loud as if talking to someone I could really see. I said, "Baby, I don't know what you want from me or how I can help you, but there's really nothing I could do without your help." I stood there for a few minutes more. I noticed something moving amongst the trees deep in the woods. It appeared to be a figure, but strangely enough, it was darker than the black forest. It was looming and moving very slowly. I couldn't tell if it disappeared or moved away, but I stood there until I could no longer see it.
James wasn't afraid. He just felt uneasy. So the very next morning, he got up and went straight to the grave. And he made an attempt to try to communicate with the spirit of the young girl.
I asked her three straight and simple questions. Who killed you? The name Peter pretty suddenly popped into my mind. Where are you from? A place I've never heard came to me, which is Fayette, Ohio. What is your name? What came to me very quickly was Caroline North.
Armed with his visions and telepathic messages, James went to tell the authorities what he knew.
He did tell the police the reason why he felt he had information is because he saw a ghost and was given information. And because of that, he was not taken seriously, of course.
And with all due respect, mm-hmm. All the vivid details that he had about the crime, mm-hmm. did you ever suspect that he might be involved?
Yes, absolutely. That was one of the first things we thought. And we asked, honestly, you know, you've never had any psychic messages before, why now? Do you really know information about her? Are you involved? Did you do it? We need to know this. And he said, no, absolutely not.
He did not care if he was made a suspect. And if that's what it took to solve it, he was prepared to accept that. So he told me to continue.
Darla says the police were reluctant to revisit a cold case that was over 30 years old. As far as they were concerned, James's evidence wasn't evidence. But Darla did believe her uncle, and she couldn't get the unidentified girl out of her mind. She had to know who she was.
I did feel as if I had inherited this weight on my shoulders, but it was also an urgency and a responsibility.
For 15 years, Darla tracked down every promising lead, trying to identify a girl she called Mountain Jane Doe. She wanted to find someone who was looking for someone who matched the unidentified girl's description. And when her amateur sleuthing didn't drum up any results, she published her work as a ghost story.
In a book that I put together mainly to bring attention to the unidentified girl, I mentioned another case very similar called the Tent Girl. And the Tent Girl was solved by a man named Todd Matthews. Todd Matthews is a researcher of cold cases, and now it's his career. Todd Matthews heard of the story, and he contacted me. That is when everything began happening, and that is when it became possible for this case to be solved.
Todd Matthews, along with the Harlan County coroner, decided to exhume the unidentified girl's body. He told him that way he could get a DNA sample and he could cross-check it against a database of missing persons. If they found a match, Mountain Jane Doe would no longer be an unidentified girl in an unmarked grave, but a real person with a name and maybe a family.
The day of the exhumation, I was very calm the whole time, even when they started bringing bones up.
When the body was exhumed, Todd Matthews got his DNA sample. And when he got the results, he called Darla.
Hello.
Hello, Darla. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
So, we do have some news. And Phillip has released the news now, and they've asked me to tell you.
Okay.
The remains that were exhumed that day in Harlan County were not the remains of our Harlan County Jane Doe. And I'm not saying that we don't have a match. I'm saying that was not her remains.
Okay.
And the grave was mismarked at some point in time.
Oh, no.
And I'm sorry. I wish I had better news for you, but I give up. I give up.
I don't know what to say. How did it happen, and where is she? It has to be the one right beside of it, right?
Very possible. I don't know how the mistake happened, but somehow it did happen. And I don't want you to think in any way that anybody's going to give up on it. Just added a whole new layer.
Well, at least we know, you know.
At least we know that part, but it's been by no means over.
Okay. All right. I know. I believe you.
All right. I'll talk to you very soon.
Okay. All right. See ya.
Bye-bye.
I gave her to him, basically, I think. I handed her off. She's his now, as far as I'm concerned. And she was no longer a legend. She was no longer a ghost. She was a real person. And I want him to take her and find out who she is and find out who her family is.
Thank you, Darla Jackson, for sharing that story with Snap. We found out about that piece on Mountain Jane Doe from the award-winning radio show Reveal and the reporter G.W. Schultz. The team at Reveal has put together a new search tool that lets listeners like yourself match missing persons with the unidentified dead. It is a real labor of love. Also, check out their new documentary, The Dead Unknown, at revealnews.org. Reveal's Michael Schiller did the voiceover. Snap's Leon Morimoto did the original score for that piece, and Michael Phillips was the voice of Uncle James. That story was produced by Mark Ristich and Eliza Smith. You've made it. Darkness has not won yet, but if you've missed even a moment of Snap Storytelling, please know this full episode is available right now on the amazing Snap Judgment Storytelling Podcast. Get it! SnapJudgment.org. Keep the Snap Nation conversating. Hit us on the Facebook, Snap Judgment on the Twitter, because I want to hear your tale of contact from the other side. Snap was produced by the most amazing team ever to hold hands in the dark. Splashing with holy water before it's too late, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Pat, the exorcist with C.D. Miller. Anna, the sacrifice Sussman. The forsaken Julia DeWitt. Joe, the neuromancer Rosenberg. Nancy, the hunger Lopez. Davey, the impaler Kim. Renzo, the headless Gurio. The Snap Judgment Goonies Choir. Anna Ellerstein. Eliza Smith, Matt Ducott, and Leon Morimoto. She who must not be named. Jasmine Aguilera. Now, did you ever go to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting late at night and see everybody there at their desk only with no eyes? Freaked me out, too. But much love to the CPB. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could hear voices coming out of that one room in the mansion your uncle told you not to go into. And when you do go into it hard-headed and can't figure out how to escape for eternity, you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNY.